I'm Kim Masters, host of KCRW's The Business. Thanks for listening to our monthly podcast. Now here's the host, Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Schneider, and this is The Spinoff. Joining me on the podcast, as always, is Mr. Joe Adalian of Vulture.com. What up, Joe? He's from KUNV in Las Vegas.
Howdy, Michael.
And our guest panelist this month is Laura Prudhomme. Laura is the TV news editor at Variety. Welcome, Laura. Thanks for joining our little show.
Thanks for having me.
So happy summer, gang. So even though some of the year's big shows have now gone away, Game of Thrones is done for the year. Fargo just wrapped up. We're moving on to a slew of new shows, and there's a lot of them coming down the pike. The Leftovers, The Strain, Tyrant, Extant, The Last Ship, all happy-go-lucky sort of looks at the future, right? Do so many shows give us an opportunity to sample a lot this summer, or is there just too much clutter? Is now summer looking a lot like the fall? That'll be one thing we talk about on today's show. Along with that, there are some big announcements coming in the world of shows that are still a few years off, including the big one, Chelsea Handler moving her E-talk show to Netflix, a talk show on Netflix. That's kind of unusual. We'll talk a little bit about that. And also, if you look at your cable guide, it's not just new show names that you're seeing, but in some cases, cable networks are undergoing extreme makeovers. Bios turning into FYI. Military Channel just became the American Heroes Channel. And HLN, the network that we knew as Headline News, may become Vice TV. So what's spurring all these name changes, and which ones are working, and which ones sound a little weird? And of course, at the end of the show, we go around the horn and talk about what our big download of the month is, what we're thinking about, what we're watching, what we're talking about the most. So moving on to our first topic, you know, the summer used to be a time when the networks, to use a big cliche that I think Joe and I have used over and over again in our stories through the years, they hung those Gone Fishing signs and programmed repeats and weird Canadian dramas and stuff like that during the summer. But a lot changed when cable started doing original programming, and suddenly some of the biggest, buzziest cable shows are on in the summer. Big names like Guillermo del Toro doing The Strain on FX. It's about a virus and vampires. Carlton Cuse, one half of the Lost power duo, is also behind that. The other half of the Lost duo, Damon Lindelof's, got The Leftovers at HBO, along with Tom Perata, the novelist. CBS has got Extant, which is another sci-fi mystery starring Halle Berry with Steven Spielberg as an executive producer. And Michael Bay's got The Last Ship on TNT, which just opened to some decent numbers this past week. So, Joe, what's going on? What's with all these summer shows? Why do you think it is that this summer we're suddenly seeing even a larger glut of new content coming to the networks?
You know, I think it's actually a symptom of a larger issue, dare I even say problem, with television right now, which is there's just a lot of content. Everybody wants to do TV these days. Every big director wants to get into the game. Producers are rushing. Every other cable network has decided, hey, let's do a show. You know, even if it's BBC America, which strikes a little bit of gold with Orphan Black, which does not really get good ratings. There's a business model to be had in putting on original content, because then it creates buzz, and that buzz gets cable operators to think that they need to pay more for these cable networks in terms of subscriber fees. And we're seeing this across the dial. If there's no such thing as a dial anymore, but you know, we're seeing
old man Adalian.
Yeah, you know, there's just a lot of content, and it needs to go somewhere. And so as a result, you know, sort of like Hitler's Germany in the 1930s, they're looking for Lebensraum, they're looking for living space, they're looking for a place to put it all. And yes, I did just draw an analogy to Hitler.
I did not expect a Hitler analogy this early on in this broadcast. Well, Laura, how are you watching all of this? Are you able to watch all of this?
Because it's our job, I feel like we have to, but it does require a lot less sleep and a lot more concentration. It is hard for us to keep track, so I do wonder how the regular audience member keeps track of it all. It is a little overwhelming at this point.
And do ratings at this point, you know, Joe mentioned that some of these networks are doing these original shows just to sort of make sure they're still on the map, that cable operators are still paying a premium for their channels. At some point, with some of these shows, Orphan Black, a good example, do ratings even matter? We're all talking about Orphan Black. It doesn't seem like a lot of people are watching it, but it's on magazine covers. It's a buzzy show. Have we sort of gone beyond the looking glass in terms of ratings mattering with some of these shows?
I feel like we have, because obviously Netflix isn't worried about letting us know their ratings. It's enough for them to tell us that their shows are doing well. And if you look at something like Sundance TV with Rectify and The Red Road, they don't even tell us their ratings. They're not measured by Nielsen either.
And yet
I disagree.
They pick up second seasons of these shows, too. What were you going to say, Joe?
I mean, I agree and disagree with what Laura said. I mean, I agree that with some of these networks, yes, ratings are secondary, and they certainly seem to be plunging forward. Long term, I'm not so sure that there won't be a, to use a cliche, tipping point, that there won't be just a place where there's so much content getting so few ratings points, advertisers start pulling out, cable operators, you know, there are already sorts of rumblings of cable operators pushing to keep costs under control, especially as big powers like Comcast, and DirecTV, AT&T now sort of, build up bulk on the other side, and they're going to sort of get tougher. You know, the whole days of everyone thinking, hey, as long as I build it, they're going to come and you're going to pay me. I don't know. I think within 5 years or so, we're going to look back at this time right now as the time where it was sort of the apex, and it's going to be at some point. I don't think every single player is going to survive. I think some people are going to cut back. And I think broadcast networks are also severely threatened because they're completely irrelevant for the most part. I mean, they're still doing some numbers, but they're certainly left out of the cultural conversation with the exception of CBS. But on the other hand, ABC put everything but the kitchen sink into their new reality show Rising Star, and TNT's The Last Ship drew more viewers. So,
Laura, let's talk about summer real quick. What show are you most looking forward to?
The Leftovers has the kind of creative quality that I like. It's a nice character drama. I never read the book. I kind of stayed away from it to kind of measure it on its own merits because I tried it with Under the Dome last year and the differences were a little too distracting for me and I kind of fell off the Under the Dome boat pretty early on. But The Leftovers has potential.
Were you a big Lost Damon Lindelof fan? Are you
I bailed out of that one early as well. It's not even the Damon aspect of it. I think just the quality of it and the time that they give it to breathe in terms of the character. It gives a few interesting possibilities.
And the idea of the show, of course, The Leftovers is about, in the book and the series, is about what happens to the people left behind when a rapture-like event takes away a good chunk, 30% or something of the population?
2%, I think. Not even 30%. Okay. Tiny amount.
And years later, it sort of society has gotten kind of back to normal, but there is sort of this weird thing hanging overhead like, oh, hey, remember when all those people just disappeared?
That's sort of like the story of network TV, isn't it?
I like that. Joe, what are you looking most toward this summer?
I think a few shows. I mean, I love the pilot for The Leftovers. I've got to watch more of the screeners, but I was intrigued by it. I'm looking forward to finally watching the second season of Orange is the New Black on Netflix because, hey, who needs seasons when you can watch it anytime you want? I've managed to avoid spoilers. So you know what? Netflix works for me business model-wise, and it's still there. I'm also looking to catch up on a whole bunch of comedies and stuff I've got on my DVR, which I think is increasingly a bigger phenomenon. People saving shows from the season when there's just too much on. And I'm going to, catch up on Modern Family, some Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and that could be a great alternative. And that's the world we live in now. People watch when they want to watch.
And ironically, that's how people used to spend the summer, was catch up by watching reruns. In some ways, we're still doing it. Now we just have, though, a whole list of new shows at the same time. So it's both a good time and a stressful time to be a TV viewer. One other thing we want to sort of talk about is, so we're talking about shows in the near distant future. Now let's talk about shows in the slightly further future. Chiefly, Chelsea Handler. The big announcement from the past couple of weeks, actually, is she obviously left her E! Show, burned some bridges there, burned some bridges at CBS when she claimed she was negotiating for a deal there, ended up at Netflix. Now this is interesting because Netflix was a place that didn't seem to be interested in doing events like talk shows or live television or sports because of the timeliness factor of that. And that's not how people traditionally watch Netflix. But maybe it was just an opportunity that they couldn't pass up. I think also Netflix suddenly is seeing themselves more like a TV network. They just can't resist sort of the power of being a TV network. As a matter of fact, in their press release announcing the deal, bringing Chelsea Handler to Netflix, they called themselves an internet TV network, which is fascinating. But so she's going to do a talk show for them in 2016. Guys, what is this? A talk show on Netflix? I mean, does this make any sense, Laura?
I think that it's admirable that they are branching out into something that you definitely wouldn't expect from Netflix. It is nice that you have a burgeoning upstart network, if we're going to call that, that's investing in a female comedian and talk show host when the rest of the networks, the broadcast networks, are going more towards the white guy, you know, extreme that we've had for so many years. I mean,
yeah.
Comedy Central has invested in Larry Wilmore, but apart from that, all the broadcast networks are kind of doubling down with, you know, Stephen Colbert and these white guys who are obviously very funny and very good at what they do, but it's not very diverse. It's not very interesting. And Chelsea Handler has always been out there. She's not doing what the other guys are doing.
Yeah. Joe, what do you think? I mean, how do you think they could or should schedule this? Is it going to be a nightly show, or do you think people are just going to binge it a month later? And how are you even timely at that point? How do you do a monologue? How do you have guests? Would a show like this even work?
You know, I am not going to get hung up trying to analyze, despite the question. I have no idea. I have no idea what the strategy is. You know, they call it a late night show, but what is a late night show now anyway? I mean, Jimmy Fallon basically seems to exist to be on YouTube. That's where his show tends to exist, although he gets plenty of good ratings on NBC. Look, Chelsea Handler had a lot of bad PR over the last couple months because she took some bad advice or someone was ill-serving her in terms of her PR or her management and put out a lot of false signals. But the fact is, this story was out there about 3 months ago. The New York Post was the first to report it. When it was reported, everyone poo-pooed it. It's like, oh, she looks desperate. Well, apparently not. Apparently she was in talks with Netflix, or Netflix suddenly got interested. I think what Netflix is doing is taking a bet on a brand name that has a core audience, and that's what Chelsea Handler is. She reaches not a huge audience, but a small, passionate, loyal audience of people who maybe aren't already subscribing to Netflix. You know, it reminds me a lot of, quite frankly, what Howard Stern did when he left terrestrial radio to go to SiriusXM. Now, Howard Stern is not as much part of the pop culture buzz anymore because he's on satellite radio, but he makes a ton of money. He helped bring new subscribers to SiriusXM, and it worked. Why can't it work with Chelsea Handler? You know, she can be as bawdy as she wants to be. She has an audience of fans who love her. Maybe it's going to be her hanging out. Maybe who knows what it'll be, you know? I think the good thing about Netflix is it doesn't have to be boxed in. We, as people who cover TV, like to think the way we like to think, because we've been thinking that way for a long time. When Netflix first picked up House of Cards and Orange is the New Black, I thought, oh, what are they doing? What do you mean putting all these episodes all at once? Well, I was wrong. It worked. Will this work? It may not. It seems like an interesting enough bet.
And in some ways, you're right. It doesn't really matter if it works or not. And how do you even measure whether or not it works on Netflix?
Know.
No, you won't know, other than, you know,
they'll
as long as
more.
That stock price keeps going up and as long as they
keep talking about
yeah,
it.
And they maintain their subscription level, then it's a success.
Up.
And it'll automatically pay for whatever her salary is going to be. And then everyone sings a happy tune once again at Netflix, the happiest place in entertainment.
And
right
I'll
now.
Bet you, by the way, that her, well, maybe her payday is huge. I have no idea. I don't think Netflix was going to go crazy for that, but we'll see. Netflix is a publicly traded company. Maybe it has to be revealed. We'll see.
The other thing that we're sort of looking down the pike at, and the other big announcement from the past couple of days, is AMC announced that they are picking up a second season of Better Call Saul, which is, of course, the Breaking Bad spinoff starring Bob Odenkirk in the role that made him legendary, I suppose. They've already picked up one season. It was originally going to be airing in fall of 2014. Now they're moving it to early 2015, but at the same time, they're picking up a second season to air in 2016. So guys, that's a lot of Better Call Saul coming down the pike. It better be good, right?
But I think that it's indicative of how networks are thinking these days. I think that viewers are very wary of investing in anything when everything gets yanked after two or three episodes if it doesn't make an impact. This way, at least, AMC is investing in Better Call Saul. They're saying, hey, it's going to be around. You can trust us. It's not going to get yanked straight away.
Right. Put your trust in Vince Gilligan. It's not going to be.
He hasn't steered us wrong so far.
It's not going to be Joey. It's not going to be after MASH, hopefully. Knock on wood. Joe, unless it is after MASH or Joey.
It's not going to be after MASH or Joey, although I think Vince Gilligan, you know, sort of joked about that in a Hollywood Reporter roundtable recently. But, you know, I think why not give it two seasons? You know, remember, these are cable seasons, so it's anywhere from 20 to 23. 24 episodes, 26 episodes, it does send a signal to viewers. AMC needs to invest in something. The fact is, investing in Better Call Saul is a safer bet than investing in a new series. And that's, you're seeing that a lot, whether it's broadcast networks like CBS doing another CSI and another NCIS, ABC just making Thursday nights the Shondaland Express. I trust in Vince Gilligan. I think the actors are great. The writing is great. Why not? Yeah, it's always good to think that networks will invest in something brand new. But, you know, that's AMC sort of passed that baton to other networks. It's its own sister network, Sundance, is where the newer stuff is going. AMC is a top 10 cable network now. It's got The Walking Dead, which is also going to get its own spinoff, which will probably be given a two-season order at some point.
Of course.
And, you know, it may be a little less experimentation, but boy, if you're going to bet on stuff, this seems like a great bet to make. And by the way, they can now plot a two-season arc. How great is that?
Well, we'll be looking forward to that. And the good news is the legacy of Breaking Bad and Vince Gilligan's creations will live on through at least 2016. So after the break, we'll talk about all those new cable channels hitting the screen, plus a big change in TV leadership. From KCRW.com, this is The Spinoff.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream, featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
We're back. It's The Spinoff from KCRW.com. I'm Michael Schneider of TV Guide Magazine, along with Joe Adalian of Vulture.com and Laura Prudham of Variety. So guys, I don't know if you've been able to keep track of all the cable networks popping down in the past couple of months. Style Network turned into Esquire. Remember a couple years ago, Discovery Health turned into the Oprah Winfrey Network. You had El Rey and Fusion, two new networks targeting millennials. You even had the Documentary Channel, a channel no one's ever heard of, turn into Pivot. So we've had all that go on. And now this year, there's even more channel makeovers, big makeovers like Bio, which was a tiny A&E channel turning into FYI later this month. It's going to focus now more on lifestyle stuff, food, cooking, do-it-yourself stuff. HLN, of course, back in the day was the headline news network. Well, for a while now, it's been the murderous wife network and whatever else they talk about on that channel. Well, they're trying to turn it into a social media network, but they're also in talks with Vice about turning into Vice TV and going after the young, hip millennial crowd. That's a theme, right? WeTV is dropping Women's Entertainment. They're just going to be WeTV. Military Channel just became the American Heroes Channel. WGN America is no longer going to be a superstation. What's causing all these makeovers? And are these channels now that sound more enticing to you, Joe? Are you starting to watch We now that it's not Women's Entertainment anymore?
No. But, you know, the thing is, this is goes back to a little bit of what I was saying before about the massive programming, but it also speaks to an even more dangerous and troublesome reality of our cable universe, and that's cable socialism. I hate to sound like Ronald Reagan here, but in a good capitalistic system, if a network were to fail, it would simply go away. But in cable, we have a system where all of us pay tens, hundreds of dollars to support cable networks we never watch. Maybe more than half the people who get cable, don't watch ESPN ever, 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 you still pay $5 a month to support it. That's fine. Lots of people support ESPN. It's a big, broad network. It makes sense. But we all end up paying, even if it's only 30, 40 cents a subscriber. And when they don't work, you get rebrandings like this because their owners are realizing, hey, you know what? That doesn't work. Rather than have to start all over and try to build up another audience and get people to subscribe all again, no, the big cable giants who are all part of these giant monopolies and have lots and lots of power use the leverage they have by, say, owning Bravo or owning USA or some other big network to relaunch these little channels. And it's outrageous, quite frankly, because maybe we don't need all these networks. If the networks that we had weren't working, why do we have to automatically subscribe to these other channels? And as someone who pays so much for my cable, I'm starting to get annoyed at all these networks that long ago forgot their own mission, turning into something else. But the fact is, when they fail and fail again, you know, it just has to be re-rented. It's ridiculous.
Joe, I think you ask a good question. Why do we need all these networks? Every study that I think we see coming out of Nielsen is that the average viewer only watches about 17 networks, which is actually up from maybe a few years ago. But that's not a lot of networks. And then the other thing is, whenever you have these networks sort of go away from their original mission plan, VH1, remember, it was Video Hits One back in the day, MTV was the music television network, and even we now going away from being women targeted to more of a sort of general interest cable network, they lose something. They become a little more bland because they're trying to broaden out and go after a much larger audience. But Laura, does that mean that all these networks start to look the same and there's not even sort of a, we can't even differentiate what these channels are anymore?
I don't know if it even is broadening out. I think that there's certainly, you know, among kind of military channel, HLN, bio turning into FYI, obviously this is kind of catering to a more niche market. They're not actually broadening out. They seem to be kind of honing in on one certain demographic and catering to that audience instead, which I think even the broadcast networks are doing that might be kind of why Kevin Reilly had such issues at Fox, because he was more narrow in his focus, whereas I think the broadcast networks kind of want to be broader.
Yeah, and some of these networks are trying to go after different crowds than before, but it's all kind of the same crowd. They seem to be going niche, but at the same time, they're all going after millennials now. So, And upscale millennials, by the way, too, not just any old millennial, but, you know, Style turning into Esquire, that was an obvious play for the young millennial male. I don't know if they're necessarily watching television, but it's an attempt to go after them. Again, Pivot, the same idea, Fusion and El Rey, two networks going after sort of a broader multicultural millennial audience, which is sort of a fresh idea. But
it all ties into what we were saying earlier, Mike. I mean, in terms of about how bad reality is doing, it's because in part everything is being diffused. All the producers are out there are rushing to put together a show for this network and that network and this network. Rather than just doing one or two shows, they're doing 10 or 15 and everything is spread thin. I mean, maybe, you know, there are only so many smart, creative people in Hollywood. Sorry. Look, and I love some of these, and some of these channels are cool, and I'd love to be there. And, you know, sometimes there's some innovation. Look, I'm glad BBC America exists. You know, I'm glad that, you know, IFC decided to get out of just airing art movies and produce Portlandia. So sometimes it works. But a lot of times it's just a desperate play to hold on desperately to channels that fail and never to give back real estate. I think sometimes these companies say, all right, this didn't work. Fine, you have this channel. We're going to move on. But they don't.
I think we are getting to that tipping point in terms of, there is much more paid attention to our cable bills now and how we are sort of subsidizing some of those networks. We've gotten to the point where the cable networks realize if they try to push it any further, then the real debate about a la carte pricing, which is, you know, what certain folks want, where you can finally pick and choose the networks you get, may become a reality. It may actually be something that Congress and the FCC start to really take seriously, and that could have a devastating effect on all of these smaller niche channels, including the niche channels that we all love and watch. I love BBC America. I don't know if that channel would survive if it wasn't for sort of the subsidized cable system we live in now. Now, I don't know if that's an argument to keep it the way it is, because there's a lot of problems, but I think also once we lose that, we're going to see some serious bloodshed.
Well, and to our earlier point, I think that because there are so many different channels, a lot of great shows that we do love are getting lost in the shuffle. Obviously, Orphan Black was kind of under the radar in the first season. It's only just kind of popped in its second season. Same thing with things like Top of the Lake, The Return, shows that are on Sundance. You kind of miss them in the loud noise and chatter of everything else that's going on.
To be fair, there are 12 different versions of Real Housewives, so there's only so many hours in the day. Right, Joe? Joe, a big Love and Hip Hop fan, I know.
I love their ratings because they're pretty amazing. But
they are pretty
amazing.
I
wish the cable industry would get together and realize that they are killing their own golden goose, because the thing is, they've got a sweet, sweet system right now. Socialism rocks for them, and it does. It makes them all very, very rich. You look at some of the highest paid executives in this country, and they're the people who run Discovery Communications, which, by the way, Discovery, I think, is actually one of the best run of these. They actually have really well-defined channels that serve niches. I mean, sometimes, you know, between TLC and Discovery and I can't even remember all their networks.
Well, they've smartly been able to rebrand some of their networks and turn them into big money makers.
And own, right.
Investigation Discovery, for example, was a moribund channel. I think it was Discovery Times at one point.
Sure.
They rebranded it as ID, and suddenly it's one of the fastest growing channels out there. Mostly mostly because it's all about murder.
Right. And well, yeah. And murder was the case. And, you know, I know, and Discovery does a really good job of that. So God bless them. But a lot of people don't. And I think these cable giants need to realize that their greed is going to cost them because they keep pushing and pushing and pushing for more and more original programming, more and more whatever. And they're gonna foster a rebellion.
Well, now we're at that point in the show where we go around the room and we each download the story or the show that we're thinking about top of mind this month. Joe, let's start with you.
What I'm thinking about and continuing my crankiness for today is Emmy campaigning. We are in the heart of Emmy campaign season, which is something that really didn't even exist that much until a few years ago. I mean, yes, TV networks have always tried to get Emmys, and there have always been ads in the trade magazines. It was always a thing. But as TV has become better than ever, which is a good thing, so too has the push for awards. You know, it's often said now that TV is the new movies. I agree. I think the best creative stuff is being done on TV, but that also means the TV industry is adopting one of the worst things about the movie business, which is Oscar campaigning. TV Emmy campaigning is not quite as bad as what goes on in the Oscar season. There's no one quite as shameless and ruthless as Harvey Weinstein yet, but the amount of energy given to promoting these Emmy consideration ads and every sort of little stunt and the importance, it just disturbs me because I think it should really be about sorry to be naive here. It should be about putting out great content. There are going to be a lot of great shows that are not going to get Emmys, but guess what? They're still really, really great shows. So I hope that all the talented people who work on them, when you don't wake up later this month or next month and get an Emmy nomination or you don't win, don't feel bad. You still did good work, and that should be a reward enough.
Yeah. Well, as long as that Emmy package contains free donuts, then I can be swayed.
Mikey.
Laura, what are you thinking about this month?
I'd like to highlight a show that I kind of discovered a little late, Rectify, which I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
To our point about shows getting lost in the shuffle, I didn't discover it until a couple of weeks ago. I'd heard all the buzz about it, obviously, but not until I saw it on Netflix did I catch up with it. Rectify is about a man released from death row after, I think, 19 years. Trying to reacclimatize to his small town and his family and the kind of people who still believe that he's guilty of the crime that he was incarcerated for. Beautifully acted and directed. And I think that Aidan Young is doing some amazing work. The entire cast is doing some amazing work on that show, and it deserves a little more love.
Yeah, it's a good example of some of the great stuff Sundance is doing right now, these quieter shows that are very indie film in spirit. And I agree with you. It's a great show, and looking forward to season two. Well, I want to wrap things up by sort of giving an appreciation for someone who is known more for his radio work than his TV work, but he did a lot of TV as well. Casey Kasem, who passed away this month at the age of 82. I know for myself and for, I believe, Mr. Dalian as well, we grew up listening and worshiping and sort of praying at the altar of Casey Kasem in the American Top 40 Countdown, and someone who I idolized as a broadcaster, as a decent human being, a humanitarian, and someone that Joe and I once got a chance to have lunch with, and it was one of the highlights of my entire career, honestly, is sitting down and hearing Casey Kasem talk about the history of the Countdown and of his amazing career. He had a voice that was par none, and sort of the kind of show that I traveled with through the years as I moved from town to town. Casey Kasem was always on the radio, always counting them down, and never with any sort of snark, just giving you the countdown, giving you the top songs of the week. Would always really appreciate just him being there. And of course, his TV output included America's Top 10, which was a syndicated TV version of American Top 40. And most importantly, he was the voice of Shaggy on Scooby-Doo and the voice of Robin and the voice of countless other cartoon characters as well. He was a legend and he will be missed. Casey Kasem passed away at the age of 82. Well, that's it for this edition of The Spinoff. Thanks a lot, Joe.
Thanks, Mike.
And thank you, Laura.
Thank you for having me.
That was Joe Adalian of Vulture.com. He's the West Coast editor there. And Laura Prudhomme, the news editor for Variety.com. You can follow Joe on Twitter at TVMojo and Laura at Low in LA, which is L-A-U in L-A. And I'm Michael Schneider, the executive editor of TV Guide magazine. My Twitter handle is at Franklin Avenue. The podcast is produced by Caitlin Parker. Melissa Morton is our technical director. And special thanks, as always, to the good people at KUNV in Las Vegas. You can hear past episodes of The Spinoff on iTunes, Stitcher, and pretty much everywhere where you download podcasts. And you can also hear it online at kcrw.com, where they just redesigned their websites looking smashing, and on demand with the KCRW smartphone app. Until next time, this is The Spinoff, signing off.
TV party tonight! Tonight.
All right!
We're gonna have a TV party, all right!
Tonight!